So, Helena, welcome to our Technology and Science podcast. Obviously, we're going to deep dive into the world of quantum and quantum physics development, which is obviously where you're focused. Do you want to give a background to yourself and what you do at the moment?
Sure. So, my name is Jelena Trbović. I'm a director of business development at Contralox, a small software company that specializes in making software for automating QPU tune-up and bring-up.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah.
I suppose the business development within quantum is obviously something that's consistently growing at the moment. What have you seen since doing business development for quantum in terms of the partnerships and the collaborations that you've brought on from that?
Yeah, so what we see basically is that you need to prepare the ground for your business, right? So that's why it's called business development. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it's a pre-sales activities and preparing the market for your product, also scouting the market, looking at what are the biggest gaps that you can fill in with the product that you're developing. So in that sense, knowing, you know, what the market is in advance, who are the main players, how can you as a company help them the most is very helpful and beneficial for the job.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, a lot of what quantum, I suppose a lot of technologies within quantum computing don't have current benefit to the market. How are you able to sell a product that isn't quite there yet? And is that the same for Contralox, or do they have a product that's ready to go right now?
Right. So there are, of course, a lot of steps that we need to go through, definitely in quantum technology. So we're not really there yet in terms of the usability of the technology, definitely when it comes to quantum computing, for example. Quantum sensing is very much used and has been used for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And what we want to do, we want to develop a product that will, first of all, accelerate the development of quantum computing in terms of, yes, you have a set of your qubits, what we're going to do, we're going to run our software, and you will not have, 3, 4, 5 people working and being basically locked onto doing that manually. So we're going to do this for you, so you can, go ahead and, have this chip available to the customers and so on, until you make better chips and so on. And then again, we will improve the software as the technology is maturing as well, right? So there'll be different requirements that we're going to have to fill in. And at the moment, it is just the sheer complexity of what needs to be done in order to have the quantum chip ready.
Yep.
for the user.
Okay, and what for you was attractive about Contralox? Obviously, you joined 4 months ago. Why were they a standout to you as a startup within the quantum realm?
Right. So Contralox, I actually knew since they were founded, because one of the founders was a customer of mine.
Okay.
in a company I was at before, Zurich Instruments. So Natalia Ayas, who started this whole work to use machine learning to tune up spin qubits, is something that I was fascinated about since 2018 when I found out about the work. And it actually ties and goes back into, me, advancing as a scientist, right? So as a scientist, there were a lot of things I had to do manually, and there were a lot of things that were slow. So one example, I also used to make quantum dots.
Yep.
As a postdoc, and this was extremely painful. So when I realized that A, she's speeding this up, B, the group is using machine learning for this, which is also an amazing AI technology, I just thought it's a breakthrough in how we do science, how we speed up the technology development. So I was excited about it since 2018, and I, when they spun out the company, was all kudos and really trying to help also from my side. And I guess, you know, coming to Contralox wasn't really something that was, you know, out of the blue, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you feel like is the benefit of working in a startup compared to a larger company?
Yeah, in a startup, well, first of all, you get to help and define how the startup will work as an organization, right? So you get to be part of an early culture definition, how the products will be developed, what will be the focus of the company. And in the startup, you can essentially move much faster. The decision-making process is simpler, shorter, compared to, you know, bigger, more established companies, because there's already a workflow and process is being established. So these are always, of course, difficult to change because it works for the organization, right?
Yeah.
And in the quantum world, that essentially needs to be available to adapt to any of the changes that we will see and we're seeing, in a small company, that's much more natural in a startup. Yeah.
Now, obviously, a part of your job, collaborating with other companies and getting partnerships with other companies, is crucial for the success of your role and the success of Contralox. How do you go about that, and why do you think Quantum is unique in how there's so many strong partnerships and collaborations so far?
Yeah, well, you asked previous question about, you know, bigger and smaller companies, right? So smaller companies essentially don't have the capability to do everything that in principle needs to be done, right? So therefore, partnerships are natural bridges, you know, between one or two or more different parties to get to that goal, right? So that's why it's very important that you're aligned with your partner as to where you want to go, right? And these partnerships essentially, you know, if for a small company as such, you have this huge step to do a certain thing, if you have a partner, then it becomes a smaller step that you can actually, you know, go to sooner, test your product, and then, you know, simply go faster to where you want it to go.
From my observations of the quantum market, collaborations within other companies, you get obviously pockets of ecosystems whereby one company will do this, we're not going to touch this because that's what another company does. We're going to see that change in the upcoming future, as I suppose VC money may get more aggressive and results are dependent upon certain levels of success. How do you think that's going to change the relationships within Quantum that so far probably been, for want of a better phrase, a bit nice?
Yeah. Now that's a really good observation. And the reason for that, there are several reasons for that, right? One is we're at the stage, definitely when it comes to quantum computing, where we still don't know which technology will have the most benefits for the future, right? When I say which technologies, you know, it's, you know, whether photonic quantum computing or atom or, you know, superconducting, spin, NV centers, hybrids, topological qubits will make it to be the most robust to the errors that we see, scalability, all these requirements that needs to be fulfilled in order for quantum computing to be useful. So at the moment, we are all understand that we need to go together as a community, right?
Mm-hmm.
See what each other, you know, has done, you know, celebrate, you know, successes even of our competitors, because it's very important that, you know, that we succeed, right? Because and also, you know, have small failures, or, you know, you don't do something that you thought you could. It's learning for the whole community. And there's also a lot of R&D involved in terms of you know, how to make the best superconducting qubit, you know, which one will is going to have least errors for the operation, the whole chip architecture, which architecture is good for you know, what application. So there's lots of forgiveness and allowing the competition to, you know, evolve together, because everything that we do is really hard, right? So we all have to find what's our niche and where we are best at, so we can then, you know, compose this all together and, you know, come up with the best solution, right?
And what do you think is, or when do you think that we're going to see a change in that ecosystem? When do you think it's going to become maybe slightly more hostile than it is at the moment?
Yeah, it could be simply no money. You know, money is and funding is of course crucial, right? So none of this would be possible without, you know, huge backing of governments, private money, and so on. And definitely governments are the ones that give strong signals to, you know, the rest of the private money and all the investors to say, you know, it's okay, we believe, we need this, we believe in this. So that's crucial. I guess governments for sure need to stay engaged, because this technology will, you know, come to its fruition. You know, it might take a little bit longer.
Yeah.
You know, not from, you know, 10 to 40 years, but maybe 10 to 12 or 13, 15 years for something. I'm not saying, you know, different people have different ideas of, you know, what needs to happen. But funding is definitely something that's crucial. And if it's not there, people will simply, you know, be competing for the small resources that are available.
Yeah.
Second, if there is, you know, a huge breakthrough, right, in technology, which will, you know, prove many others of some others to be not so useful, so these will have to dissolve or regroup, and maybe this dissolving and regrouping will not be so friendly, but it's just you know, it's life, so yeah. And anything that's not useful will simply have to disappear.
I'm already seeing a lot of we're starting to see merger and acquisitions within the quantum field already, so obviously we imagine that was gonna, that will change the landscape, where particularly some certain hardware partners might join with a software partner, for example, and that could see that move forward. You talked about government funding. I think that's a really interesting piece, because it almost feels a bit space racy in terms of how much is being invested from the governments, and there's not a single Western government that's not putting a lot of money into this, and the UK government's been very forthcoming with a lot of the funds that they're looking at. But you also mentioned timelines.
Yeah.
And there's been a bit of a buzz around the 10-year mark for some time in terms of how long it's going to take to get there. We've seen masses of developments in quantum computing, but the timeline hasn't come down from a commercially outward focused terminology, as it were. Why do you think it hasn't come down yet, and what's your view on when we're going to see more commercially available quantum technology used?
So first of all, UK government has been absolutely amazing in the whole process. I actually know that UK started since 2014 funding the quantum technologies. And mentioning the timelines, you know, even in these first days from 2014, UK has not fully, you know, understood, you know, what should be the let's say quantum technologies direction, where they should, you know, put most of the money, how, why, and so on. So in that sense, that timeline, you know, was also had to be changed because the priorities changed, right? So only I think sometime 2018, 19, or 20, can't remember exactly, did UK Quantum Technologies put quantum computing and also having the National Quantum Computing Center established, built, and so on, was there a recognition that first of all, we need quantum computer as one of the most important components of the, you know, the whole quantum technologies ecosystem, right? So you can, you know, tie that to quantum communication. Quantum sensing can, you know, work just fine without any quantum computing. But the governments do race because, you know, of all these, at least small set of problems that we think quantum computing, whoever has it first, will be able to perform, like breaking the encryption that we have and so on. So everyone wants to be ready to protect whatever the information that they have, because nobody really knows, you know, what is the level of threat. I mean, of course, there are some doom scenarios and so on, but we have to be ready because the technology is pushing forward, you know, all the geopolitical relations and so on. Not to go into that too much,
yeah.
But it is definitely what should be in the agenda of every government is, how do we use this technology the best? How do we protect ourselves from any possible threats that could come? And we won't be able to do anything about it unless we develop it ourselves, or we at least know how to use it, right?
Yeah.
And essentially, you know, respond to any of these threats.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's going to be absolutely crucial. And you're right, as much as there is such a positive message behind the quantum computing and the capabilities of what it can do, there is, there's a flip side to it of how it can be used and weaponized. And that's certainly something that needs to be recognized and something that we need to look at in terms of how we're best prepared to deal with that should it come to it.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I answered your question about the timeline, right? So partially, right, in the example of UK government. So this is an example how you need to allow yourself some time to actually understand what is the real timeline. But one great example of a company that has stuck to its timeline is IBM, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So IBM has been probably before 2010 sometime, going around universities. There were people simply talking about quantum computing and had their own timeline and saying, we will have quantum computer, you know, that could mean a 5-qubit chip, that could mean, you know, bigger chip, but they knew they were going to do it,
yeah.
Right? And so IBM has shown, you know, this year having a bit more than 1,000 qubits, that they can stick to the timeline, and they have a very ambitious one, you know, till 2030.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something, it kind of, yes, it just added another 10 years into where, you know, we think we'll be able to do something useful. And shrinkage, you know, could come, you know, all of a sudden, or could be gradual, but I think it might as well be very, very sudden due to a breakthrough in materials,
yeah,
and qubit technology.
Agree. I think that's exactly right. There is going to be a breakthrough. It's all of a sudden they're going to be like, right, this is how we can develop that, and then,
yeah,
what can we do with that further, and then it's going to snowball very quickly.
Exactly.
Let's go a bit further back to yourself. As a quantum recruiter, we get a lot of questions of how do we get to the quantum? What does that journey look like? So do you want to give us a background to your journey? Obviously your education was extremely relevant as to why you are today. So do you want to start off with your background and where you came to get to where you are?
Yeah. So as a trained physicist, right? So I continued to do a PhD in semiconductor spintronics, which, for example, is a precursor to spin qubits. So after that work, spin qubits have been essentially proposed in 98 by Lawson Di Vincenzo. Of course, work on superconducting qubits has come from developing superconductors as materials, you know, also Josephson junctions as a basically like a sensor or it's a quantum device that people have been studying for decades. And so also during my PhD and later on postdoc work at University of Basel, I started working on quantum dots. So this brought me closer to spin qubits as a technology, and essentially that gave me a lot of, well, expert know-how on how to handle these quantum devices, how to make them, how to process, you know, how to, you know, work with the refrigerator, all these things you had to learn in PhD and later on with postdoc work. And this sets a really nice foundation for understanding many different technologies, definitely in the solid state,
mm-hmm.
Including, say, topological qubits that Microsoft and others are working on. So this is what I was talking about, business development. It gives you an idea of fundamentals of the technology, so you can really recognize easily whether something is viable, you know, what makes sense, what not. So that's from the physics background. And then after my postdoc, I decided to go into industry, because during the postdoc I realized I really enjoy talking about the research that has been done.
Mm.
And not only that, but you know, you also have some great response, you know, from the audience, you know, depending on the level that you're talking, you know, whether you're trying to educate someone or just present the pure technology. And there is the element of selling, right? So how you present what you're working on, you know, how you tie to the big picture of other people and so on. So these are all the skills that you actually have to learn throughout this academic career, because everyone wants to be cited, everyone wants that their work is repeated, that it's also disputed and so on. So you want interaction around your work. And this actually helped me a lot when I moved to my industry job, first industry job, which is at Zurich Instruments, which is more on building electronics for the researchers in average lab and later on with quantum stack, how to help them actually move the technology forward, how to do better measurements, faster measurements, you know, and make this whole stack robust to, you know, using it from you know, top down, from applications down to a chip. So this was basically my journey thus far, you know. And after Zurich Instruments, of course, I went now to Controlox.
Now, one thing that's exciting about the quantum computing world is the different type of modalities and how different computers are being developed different ways. How do you feel about, I suppose, superconducting spin qubits compared to other modalities, and what else, I suppose, from a general quantum perspective, excites you or really interests you from a research perspective?
Yeah, so these so-called solid-state modalities, you know, spin qubits, superconducting qubits, hybrid systems of all kinds that will come, including, you know, inserting new materials. These are all different to say maybe atom ones, because you get to engineer them. You know, atom you cannot engineer. You can just choose which atom you want to pick as your qubit, and then what you engineer around is basically, you know, how they interact, how do they move around, how do I perform gates, and so on. But let's say with these and also trapped ions, these qubits have very, very long coherence times, and the gates have very low errors, but they're also very slow. And that's one of the, say, disadvantages of these systems, and therefore the advantage of the solid state spin superconducting qubits is that you actually get to engineer how they will work, how they will connect with one another on a chip, and also the gate time is much faster.
Mm-hmm.
So this would then allow us to perform many operations with, you know, within a runtime. We're also used to, you know, our computers have silicon processors, and this is one of the reasons why spin qubits are amazing technology. First, because we know how to make silicon chips or mm-hmm. silicon germanium and so on, and also they have very small footprint. So the size of quantum dot is you know a couple of you know 10 nanometers or less. Okay, you have leads around and so on, but we have all these you know processes worked out to a high degree. You know how you would then you know scale everything up, right? How you would connect. You know, you can easily imagine a million spin qubits on a chip, whereas, you know, superconducting qubits are much larger. You can see them with your own eyes.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the challenge, you know, how to scale up superconducting qubits, even though they have some, you know, great gate times. Also, fidelities are very high. So, and on the other hand, all of these need to be kept at low temperatures. Whereas some, like you know, in photonics, everything is you know at room temperature. So of course that's amazing. You know, there's no reason to cool down everything when you can have it, I don't know, in the office. So each of them have their own strengths and weaknesses in terms of both the you know technology around it and also you know qubit technology, right? So. And that's why it's interesting, in a sense. You know, there's a lot that can be done. Solid state qubits, just to say a few words about this. So I think we're gonna see a lot of new materials coming in, like okay. 2D materials. There's lots of groups working already on those. And I think that's an amazing platform that we should see. That's why these timelines, you know, sometimes extend, because something else kicks in that looks much better, but then you have to have research. Technology around it.
Yeah,
right.
And that's one of the things actually I want to go into, is that we again speak to a lot of people who talk about wanting to get into quantum computing or curious about it, and we're seeing the entire ecosystem expand to a point where the kind of classical physics skill sets that are demanded from a lot of the research that goes on are being exhausted.
Mm.
What other skill sets are going to be supplemented by the tech industry or other places where there's going to be a real demand for these skill sets within the quantum ecosystem, and how can people within these spaces really, I suppose, make that leap into quantum?
Yeah. Okay, so there are several layers there. First of all, to work in quantum technologies, right? So one profile is to be a physicist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. There's lots of chemists that, you know, work on quantum chemistry. Then lots of course, electrical engineers, also mechanical engineers for different things that need to be done. But, you know, electrical engineers can also be, and software engineers, of course, they're extremely important. So what they need to get is basically the understanding, what is it that they need to change or add to their know-how to adapt to quantum technologies, right? And this is a process. It's something that the people that would like to do it, right? They can already be a professional in, you know, electrical engineer or software engineers who simply shift and adapt their skills. So that's one way to do it. But then the other thing that you mentioned is that we simply won't have enough of any of these people, even if they're retrained. So this is where actually I see a lot of what Contralux is doing, but you can also expand it to other examples, is you want to develop tools that simply alleviate the whole stack of sheer manpower or highly trained manpower to be used to do things manually,
mm-hmm.
right? So there is really no need for that. And even, you know, it simply won't be possible to, say, go around and characterize a big chip. You know, even if you can put all the physicists out there, it won't be able to do it because of the complexity. And that's why it kind of is an iterative and you know, we need to develop ways of pushing the technology forward with a lot of these parallel enablement and saving of the resources, you know, as we go along. So that's, let's say, that's one way to alleviate the difficulty in not having enough people.
Yeah. Right?
So you also have to think, you know, which people, you know, should we train? Which people can we train?
What tasks can be automated?
Exactly. And also, you know, there is, in physics in general, there is, and probably other sciences I haven't looked, there is really a shortage of people to begin with that want to do physics, right? And that's why it's actually important to do these this outreach, right? You really have to motivate literally kids to be interested in science per se, and help them also solve these let's say difficult problems, like, you know, well, how do I go about the math, right? So, and still, you know, stay motivated to do science. So that's why it's important to have governments involved, because governments should help in really organizing this whole society preparation for having new technologies, because I think throughout history we've seen that, yes, things that we used to do manually, of course, we don't do anymore,
yeah.
right? And no one's really thinking about it anymore, right? And that's okay. As long as, you know, with this technology, not only we can, you know, solve and do certain problems that we couldn't do at all before, but, you know, thinking about drug discovery, of course, we all want to have new drugs discovered, you know, not in 20 years, but maybe in 1 year or 2 years. So that's one of the most important motivations, I think, we have as a community.
Yeah, absolutely. What makes you so passionate about quantum, and why is it, I suppose for me, why are you such an advocate for the technology and what you do?
Yeah, well, I think what I just mentioned about, you know, starting from, you know, starting from kids being interested in science, this is how I went through the whole journey, really interested in the stars, you mm. know, and coming to, no, I really want to be experimental condensed matter physicist, which doesn't sound so appealing at all. But in this process, actually, I discovered that with condensed matter physics, I could use the symmetries in physics that, say, people at CERN do, you know, with the discovery of I forgot the name of it. What's the name of the Higgs boson? The discovery of Higgs boson. So there's the same mechanism that that brings superconductivity in and Higgs boson. So this is amazing thing about science, how symmetries are really important, for example, to actually know that you will be able to, that if you know that there is a symmetry in physics, you know that with the right tools, you'll be able to find it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's why I also think that, you know, with quantum technologies, the technology is there. We just need to, the physics is there. We just need to learn how to use it. And that's why I would not like to see the whole movement that we're in now, you know, slump to some point where people will, you know, start having a lot of doubts and so on.
Yeah.
But that this is really, you know, moved from ground up, and that we continue the work.
Fabulous. If I look at the
mm-hmm.
quantum ecosystem, there's pockets of hubs of things going on. You've got the Delphi ecosystem, you've got a huge kind of movement for the Danish ecosystem, which is doing a lot at the moment, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
We're seeing Quantum Basel at the new startup phases for that. And there's bits, obviously, around the UK, in other areas of Paris, again, a huge startup. And they're kind of... they're not necessarily competing against each other, but they are working in their own ecosystem. How does that work, link on a global level? And are we seeing any more partnerships with companies in the US or other parts of the world that could be, I suppose, instrumental for how this technology develops?
Well, Controlox is actually an interesting company because it's been spun out during the pandemic. And it's been spun out of University of Oxford, started in Oxford, and then moved headquarters to Finland,
mm-hmm.
where there is also a very, very ambitious and very important ecosystem. And now I'm in Switzerland, and also we're close to a Quantum Basel. So, and again, we have a lab in Delft. So we're also part of Delft quantum ecosystem, and we work very closely with them. In Delft, we work with Qblox,
mm-hmm.
and Quantware the most, Qblox with electronics, Quantware with chips. And over in Finland, we have a partnership with Semicon. So it's a company that makes semiconducting spin qubits.
Yep.
And of course, in the UK, very close to NQCC, we have projects with them, and we are at many places at the same time. So we try to get the, you know, contribute and get the best out of all these different ecosystems. But of course, there are other ones, you know, across in the US, of course, in Asia, Australia, right, that are very very important, right? The very strong spin qubit community in Australia is going to be very important for us, and it is actually. We, you know, the founders have done a lot of joint work with Australian researchers, and I think what one needs to be careful about is, well, the governments that are the enablers, they can also, you know, and are putting, you know, some sort of constraints around the, you know, the experts, export control. So all these things we need to be careful about how you invest in a certain relationship and whether, you know, you'll be able to, you know, once the technology is ready, you'll be able to, you know, use it elsewhere and so on. So these are the things we need to be careful about.
Hmm.
So it's pretty, it can get complicated, you know, depending on what technology you talk about and how the governments see it as, you know, as potential threat, you know, if you export it someplace else, whether it's going to be used against you. Unfortunately, this language has come in already. So, but again, all these things that are happening around the world are, you know, closely monitored and again, celebrated, learned from by all of us, right? So it's tight-knit community still, you know, within these definitely qubit modalities, communication, sensing, and so on. Yeah.
Was that strategic for Controllox to put themselves in those locations to have those partnerships, or was it about having access to the technology? What was the purpose of being spread for such a small company to have those kind of engagement or availability to those different types, to tap into those different resources from different ecosystems, is massively valuable.
Yeah. So again, there are several reasons for this. So being spun out of University of Oxford in the UK, we realized that actually when we bid for a European grant, that we will not be able to, you know, work with it because of the Brexit, unfortunately. Mm. So, and you know, part of the company is Finnish. From the management and the founders. So it was natural to move to Finland because also there is very strong expertise there. There are Blue Forces there and universities, VTT, and so on. So all this ecosystem would have also been very important for Controllox to simply be able to deploy its technology. And then the reason for being in Delft is because we started using Blue Force's Delft lab as our experimental and development lab. So what we have there is a Blue Force fridge. We have Quantware chips and electronics from Qblox, Quantum Machines, and Zurich Instruments, and we develop our software directly on these chips with the electronics. So at the end of the day, what we want to do is enable, you know, different layers of the users, be it research lab or government or industry, to already start using the software on the hardware that they have, meaning control electronics hardware and their QPUs, which are now actually just superconducting qubits. So we wanted to solve, you know, a lot of these issues that people have every day, right? So, you know, instead of having a postdoc and two graduate students, you can have even a master student run the tune-up of your quantum chip.
Yeah.
And simply solve that. There is another a reason, and that's the talent is not all in one place. The talent is really spread around the world, right? Of course, it has to have certain, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if we are also in Australia, US, and Asia, there's going to be some serious coverage of communication that needs to be done, right? But we have decided to, you know, make teams there where the talent is, where the technology is, and you know, just optimize for best use of the talent.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Look, thank you so much, Elaine. I think that's been really good insight into
partnerships,
what you guys are doing. Amazing to hear what Controllox is doing, and yeah, exciting to see what happens next.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and I really enjoyed this, and yeah, let's see if you know, and any of these thoughts will make any sense in a couple of years or not, but or 10 years, but it's certainly exciting times, and I really hope that, you know, people that are already in the industry, they think about how I can contribute to quantum, they can also come to you, and you know, I'm sure you'll give them a good advice.
Absolutely.
How to get engaged.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Perfect. All good.